Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, Vanity Fair political correspondent and national editor Tom Purdom will join us in just a minute. His article in the new issue is called Washington, We Have a Problem, and it's about the disintegrating political culture of the United States Congress and, by extension, the United States as a nation. Todd has been watching this happen for a long time. He was a New York Times White House correspondent in the Clinton years, and he asks whether President Obama is as serious about trying to fix our broken system in office as he was during the campaign. Obama says he is, as in his commencement address this spring at the University of Michigan. Here's a clip.
If you're somebody who only reads the editorial page of the New York Times, try glancing at the page of the Wall Street Journal once in a while. If you're a fan of Glenn Beck or Rush Limbaugh, try reading a few columns on the Huffington Post website. It may make your blood boil. Your mind may not be changed. But the practice of listening to opposing views is essential for effective citizenship. It is essential for our democracy.
President Obama from this spring in a commencement address. That clip is cited in the article. Also, Todd Purdom's take is that the press may have the nickname the Fourth Estate, but the real fourth branch of government today is the lobbying industry. Hi, Todd. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks. Nice to be here, Brian.
Where did that nickname Fourth Estate come from, by the way? Do you happen to know?
I believe it comes from France, in which in pre-revolutionary France, I'm going to get this wrong, but the nobility was one and the clergy was another and the royalty was one. It has to do with divisions of society, and there were only three, I think, and the press was meant to be, in modern American times, sort of the fourth branch of government. But effectively speaking, lobbying is now really the fourth branch.
And you quantify in the article some of the ways that the lobbying industry has grown. Excuse me, even in pretty recent years. Can you run some of those numbers for us?
Well, it's sort of astounding. Lobbying industry spent about $3.5 billion in Washington last year, and the single largest expenditure was by the United States Chamber of Commerce, which, of course, opposed much, if not all, of President Obama's most important initiatives, and their spending exceeded the combined payroll of all 535 members of Congress.
When Congressman Rangel, who we just heard speak in the newscast, is brought up on ethics charges for helping an oil company get a special tax break by using his congressional letterhead, and the ethics problem is defined as which letterhead he used rather than the outsized influence of a loophole-seeking oil company in the first place, maybe somebody's missing the point?
Well, there you have it, as the British might say. I mean, it is a kind of a situation in which people are usually arguing about the shape of the table instead of really the substance of the matter. And I think most people agree that in the past 40 years or so, that has been a truly qualitative change in the way Washington has worked.
Now, knowing you were coming on, we put a question on our Facebook page asking people what is wrong with Washington. And Robert writes, the right to petition the government has destroyed this country. Special interest money has made doing the right thing on behalf of the people an impossibility. Eric wrote, it's not how D.C. works that's the problem. It's how we work. From the pundits to the rallies, we are not a public that can tolerate each other's views, and we slip into ideological extremes. This polarizes both the coverage and the content of politicians and their politics. Peter writes, money, 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 money. And Kavita writes, in a nutshell, election politics makes it very difficult to invest in long-term systemic policy changes. We go in one direction for 4 years and then undo it over the next 4 years. And our directionless education system, healthcare system, et cetera, demonstrate this quagmire. And Todd, I think those are all very thoughtful responses. And I think they demonstrate how difficult this whole problem is, because look what some people were pointing out as part of the problem. Our very democracy itself with elections, which means we could lurch from Bush for 4 years or 8 years to Obama for 4 years or 8 years, you know, or the right to petition the government, which is such a fundamental right in a democracy that they didn't have, you know, in France back then. And yet it's become so perverted by lobbying in the way it's become.
I mean, it's a testament to how thoughtful your listeners obviously are, Brian, but those are good points. And, I mean, I think one of the things about the electoral system that is so perverse is that it now costs so much money to get elected to Congress. People have to campaign all the time. They have to go home to their districts to raise money, which means they don't know their colleagues here in Washington because, by and large, they don't live here. So if you don't know your colleagues, it's a lot easier to be unfriendly and uncivil to them in public debate. The House operates under rules now that very seldom allow for open, real debate on the floor of the sort that could change people's minds but by virtue of you know, arguments that are put in place over the course of an hour or so. And in order to raise enough money to win their campaigns, they have to raise money from lobbyists. Lest everyone think lobbyists are purely evil, I think, you know, I have a lot of friends who are lobbyists, and I think it is probably worth also saying that the government has become so big and complex, and the regulations and rules and the way that government reaches into every corner of national life, lobbyists do perform an important function in many times, which is that they are the only ones, because they represent people who are interested in the question at hand, who really know how something works in a given field. I mean, lobbyists for the energy industry do know a lot more about energy production than the typical member of Congress. So if they're honest lobbyists and if the members are honest, you know, lobbyists can provide an important educational function for people to understand how things really work. I remember once I was interviewing a lobbyist, I believe it for the aircraft industry, and he was explaining to me that he was working with a member of Congress who, implausibly enough, had never really flown. And this person didn't understand sort of how airplanes worked at a basic level. And I think that's probably an extreme example. But, you know, they do perform. It is important for the public to have the right to petition the government. The problem is when it gets all perverted and the money is sloshing around in such large amounts.
Right. So what is President Obama's relationship to all this? Does he really seek to be a change agent, as he appeared to people in his campaign? Or is he trying to pursue the content of his agenda, health reform, banking reform, et cetera, without really tackling the erosion of our democracy that's taking place beneath the surface?
Well, I think he's trying to play a kind of two-dimensional or three-dimensional chess. He certainly has not forsaken playing the game as it exists because he knows that's how you get things done. So, I mean, he and his White House staff were right down there in the trenches on questions like health care reform or financial regulatory reform or education, and if they get so lucky as to try to do climate change legislation, they'll be in the thick of that too. So they're using all the traditional kinds of tools at their disposal, and they're down in the weeds. But then the president does seem, at the same time, to be trying to, at his bully pulpit level, articulate a different vision, as he did in that Michigan commencement speech. And he urges his aides, and I know this because they all say that he does, to not get bogged down in the daily battles over the news cycle and who's up and who's down. And I think he really does try to urge them to play for the longer game, to play for the month or the year instead of the day or the week. And they obviously don't always succeed, but I think he never stops articulating that as a goal. And his senior aides all tell me that he has a posture of sort of perpetual bemusement and even sometimes amusement at how crazy life in Washington really is, and that he sometimes just shakes his head and shrugs his shoulders and says, you know, what are we going to do?
Although despite that one passage from his commencement address that we played and that you quoted in your article, he doesn't seem to be making this a crusade or something that's constantly on his lips. So maybe he tries to ignore it to some degree and keep focusing on the big picture. Your article is about how they keep getting drawn in to the 24-hour news cycle because to some degree they can't help it. If they don't respond, they're going to get politically buried. But I think some of his original supporters are disillusioned because he hasn't made it more of a public crusade.
Yes, I think that's probably true. But, you know, if you look at it, President Obama, in some ways, is not by nature a crusader. I don't mean to demean him by saying this, but he's kind of a plodder. I mean, he just puts one foot in front of the other and keeps going on. The interesting burden that he bears is because he inspired so many hopes in so many people, came into office with 80% public approval rating. No one gets approval ratings like that unless, to some degree, the public is projecting whatever it wants to onto President Obama. And let's remember that he wasn't really a very well-known figure in national life. He'd had a comparatively short career in the Senate. So a lot of people didn't know that much, perhaps, about his essential views on various policy questions, and he had not articulated great detail on some questions. So as he's adopted one policy or another, he's bound to disappoint one set of supporters or another. And as you see in this recent flap over his press secretary, Robert Gibbs, complaining about the criticism from the quote-unquote professional left, in some ways President Obama has faced a lot of criticism from his own Democratic base, which has complicated his efforts to get things done. But I think he's smart enough to know that nobody likes a scold. Nobody wants a president who's always lecturing them. We saw with President Jimmy Carter that the public, you know, did not like the idea that the president seemed to be blaming the public for a crisis of confidence in American psyche. So I think the president has to kind of strike a careful balance, and his aides tell me this, between sounding like a scold and sounding like someone who's trying to rally people to a better way of doing business.
Todd Purdom, my guest on WNYC, national correspondent for Vanity Fair. His new article about the systemic issues in politics in this country is called Washington, We Have a Problem. Listeners, what do you think are the fundamental problems with the American political system? Do you think things are actually getting worse? And what would you propose to fix it? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, or post to WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. Some more that came in on our Facebook page earlier in the hour. Krista writes, since I've been unemployed, I've been paying close attention to how the government works, spending weeks watching the Senate on C-SPAN, for instance. It reminds me of an elementary school playground, the way the senators play games with each other. Eric writes, the never-ending election cycle. They need more time between elections to do what they actually think will improve the nation without worrying about it showing up out of context in an attack ad. And Michael writes, for 20 years now, I've asserted that we don't pay members of Congress enough. You get the government you're willing to pay for. Wall Street first-year hires make more than a senator. This creates financial desperation, corruption, or worse, a Congress dominated by wealthy people. Some of our Facebook comments.
Wow.
You want to react to any of those?
Research assistants.
Yeah, they're all going to apply because they're probably all unemployed if they're posting at this hour of the day. Mike in Jersey City, you're on WNYC. Hi, Mike.
Yeah, hi there. You know, I've got to be really amused by all this carrying on about how evil and corrupt government has become, as if there were some sort of golden age. The story I wanted you folks to comment on that I related to the screener was George Washington's first run at public office to be elected to the Continental Congress. He campaigned by spending $900, which was a lot of money back then, to buy hard cider to hand out as a way of winning political support. And his comment after being successfully elected was that he probably should have spent more money to buy more hard cider. So, I mean, that's the father of our country doing politics. How bad is now compared to then?
Well, do you conclude from this, Mike, that it's that really nothing has changed? We're just doing a lot of hand-wringing?
I think human nature hasn't changed. And we are doing a lot of hand-wringing. All that's really changed is the manner in which we deal with human nature. And the real question is not whether we're more corrupt, less corrupt, et cetera, but whether the problems are getting solved. George Washington bought hard cider, but he got a lot of problems solved when he became president. It's not clear that that's happening now or has happened with a lot of really big problems like Social Security, health care, these things. They haven't really been effectively addressed in the way that big problems have been addressed in the past. The point, therefore, is not going through all worrying about all the window dressing, but questioning why is it that government is no longer addressing big problems.
Todd, you want to take a good belt or two and answer Mike's question?
Well, I think Mike makes a very fair point about the immutability of human nature and the fact that human nature hasn't changed very much. And yes, there's been rough and tumble in American politics from the beginning. And I say in the piece that, you know, you could argue that polite discourse has gone steadily downhill in Congress since 1789, and that my esteemed colleague is often sort of code for, you know, USOB. But I think one thing that has changed is the speed and impatience of the modern media and the way that that carries over to the electorate and to the public. So I think that George Washington or Abraham Lincoln or Franklin Roosevelt had a great luxury that current presidents don't have, and that is it took time in the age of candlelight and clipper ships for news to move around. A lot of the rules of Congress today are legacies of the time when it took people two or three days, you know, by stagecoach to get to Washington from Philadelphia or New York. And so in an age when a single blogger with a laptop anywhere in the world can either cause a tremendous news story, or if they're a terrorist, can cause a terrorist attack. We live in an age in which events are moving so quickly, and the pressure for any politician to respond to them is so intense that it's very, very hard to get the public to buy into the notion that long problems take a long time, big problems take a long time to solve.
Right. I mean, on the historical view, we were definitely having the same conversation about crazy polarization when you were a New York Times White House correspondent during the Clinton administration, right? And the country was having it during civil rights. The country was having it during the Civil War. The country was having it during Vietnam. So maybe on one level, at least, this is more historical than ahistorical.
Yes, I mean, more normative than atypical.
Correct.
That is kind of the natural condition of life that we have conflict. Yes, I think that's true. The only thing I could say, and perhaps this is a feature of my own aging and the fact that I'm now, 50 and not 35, but when I go to the White House now and I watch what current White House reporters have to do and do compared to what, I mean, I thought it was sort of an insane pace when I was covering the White House, but it seems it has almost no relation to the feeling that I had then now. It seems so much more hyperkinetic, so much more speeded up, so much more trivialized. And perhaps, as I say, that's a projection of aging. I mean, it's hard to get used to having doctors and policemen be younger than you, and now the President of the United States is younger than I am, and that's a sobering reality.
Todd Purdom, Vanity Fair national correspondent, on his article about the underlying systemic problems in our political system. Frank in Hoboken, you're on WNYC. Hi, Frank.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for putting me on. I just wanted to ask, we have a situation where the U.S. is losing economic ground overall for maybe the past 20 years. The average purchasing power of the family has gone down. We know all about that. There's less to go around. There's less for Congress to do. Is that part of the polarization process, simply because even though the dollar numbers are bigger, really, we're actually getting relatively poorer as a country?
Todd?
Well, I think that's part of the problem, yes, and one of the other issues is that, Congress is reflexively, and the sort of mantra particularly of the modern Republican Party, has been reflexively anti-tax. But nobody in Congress is willing to be correspondingly anti-spending. So we face a situation in which Congress, and by extension the public, wants at some level the same degree of services, the same degree of goodies, and is less and less willing to pay for them. So, eventually there's got to be a tremendous gap between expectation and reality going forward. And I think that's one of the things that, we've seen in recent years. President Bush talked fiscal discipline, but the government expanded greatly under his watch, in part because of post-9/11 security-related spending. But
can I break in with just one follow-up?
Sure.
If you look at the 60s, LBJ was spending like the drunken sailor, and we were able to do it because, really, we were a colossus among world economies. I don't think that's the case any longer, and that's part of the problem.
Yes.
Well, that's actually one of the points.
Much to spend.
That's actually one of the points I make in the article, that, a lot of these problems were in some ways covered up in the 50s, 60s, and 70s by the fact that America was the last one standing post-World War II, economic behemoth, and that countries that have since, think about the economic power of China in 1970 versus now. There's no comparison. So, yes, I think that's really true. And at some level, I suppose what we haven't done as a country is adjust our sights to the reduced realities of our circumstance and, settled for less. It's not in the American nature to want to settle for less.
And thanks a lot for your call, Frank. Todd, here's a comment from our webpage that I'd like you to address. Mike writes, in response to the clip that we played and that you cited of President Obama in that University of Michigan commencement address this year, saying that people should listen to the other side's media, listen to Rush Limbaugh, Glenn Beck, or read the Huffington Post. And this listener writes, one of the major problems that he is not addressing, but in fact adding to in that commencement address, is the false perception that all issues have two valid and opposing arguments to them. There are not two arguments to every issue. For opinion, sure, but on issues of scientific fact, there is only one correct issue, and the other side, be it Glenn Beck or the left, are simply wrong, and the other side should not be given any credibility. This is the central problem in Washington, writes our listener Mike.
Well, I have to agree with Mike, and I think one thing that I would warn him is that in that speech, in another passage, unless I'm badly mistaken, President Obama cited something that the late Daniel Patrick Moynihan, our senator in New York, used to say all the time, which is everyone's entitled to his own opinion, but not to his own facts. And I think one of the unhappy developments in the modern media is that, an outfit like Fox News has grown up essentially saying, we will create a set of red facts and blue facts, and we'll have our facts and you'll have your facts, and never the twain shall meet. And I do think President Obama is pushing back hard against that, and I agree wholeheartedly with the caller that, as Tevye used to say, sometimes there really is no other hand. And I think it's getting... one of the things that's been troubling about the modern media environment, especially, and President Obama's advisors talk about this, his senior advisor Valerie Jarrett, for example, said it used to be if there were falsehoods being circulated, such as the president was not born in the United States or something like that, that a Walter Cronkite might have been able to go on the air and say, this is hooey and it's got to stop. There's no figure like that now, and the media, as broadly speaking, is not trusted in that degree. And secondly, straight news organizations like the New York Times or CNN or whatever are very, very reluctant to say XYZ person is lying or this is not true. They may write stories suggesting that, but it's very hard somehow, and I know this after 23 years at the paper, I'm quite sure that I never wrote a story in which I said in so many words that Congressman Smith was, quote-unquote, lying.
You have a lot more freedom to do that at Vanity Fair than you did at the New York Times, correct?
In some ways, long-form narrative journalism does allow that freedom, and in some ways it even requires that freedom. And I have to confess that, it's been somewhat refreshing to be able to look at events and after spending time looking at the evidence, say what you really think.
By the way, on Twitter, we asked folks if they could sum up what's wrong with Washington in 140 characters. And Meg writes, they all judge others for being inferior, fail to realize the same is true for selves. No one in D.C. is moral, cool, or right. That's a lot in 140 characters. Kaferig writes, don't hate the players, hate the game. And Lindsay writes, I don't need 140 characters, just 11 Republicans.
Well, I think those are all interesting viewpoints. I'm sure there could be some Republican who's, has wrote back Democrats. But I think that don't hate the players, hate the game. I think that actually sums up President Obama's view rather neatly. I think that's his attitude. I think he thinks Washington is full of good people, hardworking people, who are all stuck in this awful game. The thing that's depressing to me about Washington is 98% of the time, what you see happening in Congress or what you hear people saying is just not true. Senator Michael Bennett of Colorado, who just won his primary challenge last night, mm-hmm. He said the other day, when he first came to Washington, he said in George Packer's piece in The New Yorker, I believe, a marvelous piece about the dysfunction in the Senate, that someone had sidled up to him and said, don't think this is all on the level. It's really not on the level in terms of the kinds of debates that go on. And he said, as he's been in office, he's come to realize, to his dismay, that in fact much of what goes on in public in Washington is not on the level, and that the fix is in and the game is rigged and people play their assigned roles in the same way that when you go home for family vacation, all of your siblings revert to the same way they were when they were 12 and 13, because that's just what you do. And in a way, that's how Washington works, too.
I'm sorry to say we're out of time, because I think this is such an important conversation and so many more people have good things to add, including potential solutions. So maybe you'll come back and we'll do a part two at some point. And of course, we have aspects of this conversation with a lot of people all the time on this show. But I want to come full circle and start and end where we started out on the notion of the fourth estate, the press as the fourth estate, and what that means. We looked it up, and according to an explainer in the San Francisco Chronicle, it was Thomas Carlyle, a British historian of the 19th century, who popularized the term fourth estate in reference to the press. Carlyle credited an earlier man of letters, Edmund Burke, with the phrase, saying that Burke had observed that in addition to the three estates represented in Parliament, kings, lords, and commons, there was a fourth estate, the press, more powerful than them all. So Thomas Carlyle, via Edmund Burke, says the San Francisco Chronicle.
Thank heavens for the Internet.
And anything, you're a journalist, not a reformer, but do you make recommendations?
Oh, you know, I don't believe in the perfectibility of man, but I think one thing that would be good is just everyone to take a breath, you know. Everyone to take a little more time to actually, I know time is the thing no one has in Washington, but to just take a breath before deciding you know all the answers. And, you know, the conventional wisdom so often has turned out in recent years to be wrong, including the conventional wisdom that Barack Obama could never be president. So I think people ought to just... people ought to remember that we don't have all the answers. And in journalism, the questions are always more interesting than the answers anyway.
Todd Purdom, national editor for Vanity Fair. Todd, thanks a lot.
Thanks so much, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Still to come, why giving computers to all low-income children could actually be a bad thing. And we'll talk to the authors of a new book called Around the World in 80 Diets. It's arranged in ascending order by calorie count. Chapter 1 is about a woman who eats only 800 calories a day. The book ends with someone who consumes 12,000. Stay with us.